Welcome to the Activation Podcast, brought to you by the Conscious Resistance Network. I'm your host, Derek Bros. In every episode of this podcast, we're going to explore solutions in the areas of health, permaculture, growing your own food, technology. We'll be interviewing guests who are providing important solutions that are more important than ever in this time we are living in. The Activation Podcast is focused on bringing you cutting-edge solutions to empower humanity. Hey everyone, this is Derek Brodes with the Activation Podcast, and I'm back with another guest that I think will be an enlightening conversation and something that those of you in the audience who are regular listeners will enjoy sinking your teeth into and kind of taking apart some of the concepts we're going to go through today. I want to just dive in. We're with Mr. Paul Kudnack, and Paul, I mean, first of all, am I saying your last name correctly? I apologize.
Yeah, well, Kudnack, I say.
Kudnack, okay, perfect. Well, let's just dive in. Tell everybody a little bit about your work, and we're going to dive into a few of your essays and some of the areas that you've written about. But tell us a little bit about your background and how you got into, you know, this particular line of work.
I worked for many years as a professional journalist on a local newspaper in England, and at the same time, I was an activist and an anarchist activist. It's been 30 years now that I've been an anarchist. So I had a sort of double life, really, I suppose you could say, of nurturing some ideas that were of interest to me personally while still carrying on this profession of being a journalist. But then I was able to give up the day job, as they say, and devote my time just to writing about what really interests me. So I wrote a book, which was published by Winter Oak Press, which is what I've self-published it essentially, because that's me. And that first one was in 2013. It's called the Anarchist Revelation: Being What We're Meant to Be. And I haven't stopped writing books since then. Luckily, I've been able to continue doing that. And I've been trying to develop a particular philosophy, I'd say more than just merely a political position, but based on anarchist ideas as I interpret them.
Yeah, and so let's talk some about that. And the website that you said it's your home for your publishing, as well as you've hosted different authors there. That's winteroak.org.uk. Is that correct?
Yep, that's it. Yeah.
And one of the more recent, as you said, I mean, you're a prolific writer. I appreciate all the time you put in. As a writer myself who desperately wishes I would dedicate more time every day, I appreciate your tenacity and your dedication, especially at this really important time. I wanted to get into Fascism Rebranded just right off the bat. This is one that you published, I believe, in 2021, Fascism Rebranded, Exposing the Great Reset. Now, before we get into the specifics of this, you said you have been an anarchist for 30 years now. And so I'm imagining in that time period, you've seen a number of changes take place and shifts in views and perspectives on, let's say, what may be acceptable or what is dogma almost at this point. And we saw this rear its head during COVID-19, the idea of what anarchists are supposed to believe or what anarchists are supposed to support. And in this case, the general message on the left, or maybe what was the left, was for the anarchists that we're supposed to support the science, we're supposed to support the lockdowns, and that anybody who is challenging these things is a right-wing nut who is anti-science and a QAnon conspiracy theorist of the worst kind, you know, these sorts of things. And within that, you know, all that going on, you published this essay, Fascism Rebranded. So yeah, maybe before we get into it, you could kind of set the stage for what called you to write this in the first place.
Yeah, well, in fact, it's a collection of articles that were originally on various websites, mainly on Winter Oak. I chose to start the selection from a couple of years before COVID in 2018, when I was already writing about the similarities between our contemporary system, and which we normally call liberalism, and the historical fascist Nazi system, which was a, I mean, it wasn't a prophecy I didn't see the COVID thing and the Great Reset and everything coming in so many terms. But there was that sort of, I had this feeling, well, I'm sure I wasn't the only one, but there was this, I had a feeling that we were heading that way. And I wanted to warn people about this, about the convergence of so what appears on the surface to be liberal and left-wing thinking, even, and the real agenda, which had remained hidden for a long time, but which was coming to the surface, which is of a hardcore authoritarian, totalitarian system, really, which we have now seen manifest itself.
Yeah, and let's. So maybe I can probe a little deeper because I do want to get into some specific essays that you covered. But what I find interesting, from what I know of your background, which is I would not say a whole lot, but from what I'm hearing your perspective and seeing your writing, I get the feeling and that your politics have been more associated with the left in prior years before COVID. Is that, would that be accurate?
Well, yeah, I suppose so. I mean, if you call anarchism,
I think most people, whether rightfully or wrongfully, and in the U.S., I'll speak from my perspective. Definitely, a lot of the anarchists I grew up around politically in my early activist years were definitely like the left wing anarchist types. And I mean, I really don't even like to put anarchists in terms of left and right, but let's say people who are, as you mentioned, kind of would maybe associate more with terms like liberal or progressive or, anti-statist variety of that. Those are a lot of the types that I grew up around, that I came to believe and understand the values of mutual aid and, coming together in a decentralized, non-hierarchical way. And a lot of the concepts that are still really important to my work and my activism in my life today. And yet those were the types that, again, when it came to much of the, even before COVID, but let's say the building up of technocracy and then particularly biosecurity state we saw and the authoritarianism we saw in response to COVID-19 or in reaction to it, there was really not much pushback from that same crowd. And so, and tell me if this is a familiar experience for you in any ways. I found myself, for example, being invited to speak at anti-lockdown rallies, and I go to these rallies where I was sure I'll come share why I think this is important to stand against this or, raise your voice and whatnot. And it would be people who had Trump flags, people who were waving Blue Lives Matter flags, definitely people who I wouldn't see eye to eye on a number of issues. But at the same time, these were the people who were standing up and pushing back against the mandates and some of the insanity. Is that something that you've seen or experienced as well?
Yes, yeah. When I live in France now, and summer, when they introduced the vaccine passes, well, sanitary passes, pass sanitaire they called it to start with, because anyway, the COVID passes, I was started going on the protests, a lot of protests all over the place, and they were mixed, but there were a lot of French flags being waved, which is not something you'd have seen on the on a left wing protest, But interestingly, because I'm in France, I was also attending Gilets Jaunes demonstrations and reporting on them, and they were, in fact, they got there before the COVID moment in having this strange alignment of people who shouldn't in theory be aligned according to contemporary wisdom. So you had when the Gilets Jaunes originally were accused of being right wing. There was some basis in that some of them were. They were part of the even part of the extreme right, some of them, but it wasn't the majority. And left wing, particularly anarchists, did get involved. And so we already had a shadowing of that, and the Gilets Jaunes have appeared again in the movement against the Great Reset, to put it widely, against passes and the rest of it. So I think that France was a step ahead of what might have happened elsewhere in that respect.
Yeah, I find that really interesting, that it sort of it precipitated the necessity for coming together of people who would typically be seen as on opposing ends of the political spectrum. Unfortunately, it's not something that seems to be coalescing to a large degree in the United States or even in Mexico, where I'm based now, around these issues, around a lot of the things that you're writing about here in your book. But I do think that that's really where it's going to need to go, is that coming together of people who, I mean, I do see it in some instances where I'm out giving talks and talking to people. Again, there's a mix of people who are more conservative and sort of seen as right wing, or maybe even people would call them far right in some cases. And then people who in the U.S., like, for example, say, I'm a lifelong Democrat and I don't fit in with those people anymore. Or, you know, I've grown up calling myself a progressive and things have shifted and now I don't align with those people anymore. So there are some new alliances forming. I think that's one of the interesting aspects of the times we're in now. But mm-hmm. I'd like to jump into some of your different essays. And before we get into some of the more esoteric elements of your writing, which I really appreciate, let's continue with talking about the Great Reset. And I wanted to get into resist the fourth industrial repression, because the fourth industrial revolution, that term is something that those in my audience, most of them are going to, you know, probably be familiar with that. Klaus Schwab using that from the World Economic Forum, his book of the same title, things of that sort, and what that entails. But could you talk a little bit about that idea and then also the ways that you feel people can resist?
Yeah, I mean, the fourth industrial repression, that the essay, obviously I've turned the revolution into repression, because that is closer to the reality, a lot closer to the reality. And I start off by explaining the first three, because I think that is, in general, that is an important point, that everything that is happening at the moment with the so-called Great Reset is the culmination of things that have been happening for at least hundreds of years, specifically with the industrial age. So we've seen a progressive, to use that word in the word progress and progressive is often used in a positive sense by people who support contemporary society, but I don't quite see it that way, because we've seen a progressive deterioration of the conditions of life for most of the human species over the last few hundred years, starting in my home country in England, where, you know, the Enclosures Act, but people were thrown off the land, deliberately thrown off the land, and then were available as surplus labour to go and work in the new dark satanic mills, to use William Blake's famous phrase, or to go and people the colonies, you know, and manage the empire and the rest of it. And gradually that spread everywhere else, and gradually we had industrialization, electrification, and now we're at this now we're at the digital phase, obviously, already, and they want to take it even further into this thing that they call the fourth industrial revolution, but which is in fact just the acceleration and advance of this horrible process of, for me, it's a process of enslavement rather than anything else. Yeah. So, and how can people resist? I think that, we just have to all refuse to go along with it. I mean, already I think they were getting frustrated by people's refusal to wholeheartedly embrace everything they've got in line for us. Hence the need for crises to emerge, which will enable them to push it further without our consent, essentially. And it was interesting in Klaus Schwab's book on the, I think it was the COVID book, yeah, he talks about the other moments in history which have enabled this, which were also windows of opportunity, to use his term, narrow windows of opportunity, at which point things were able to be pushed forward, their agenda of enslavement and technological advance was able to be pushed forward suddenly. And he talked about 9/11, for example, which paved the way for all sorts of surveillance. And it became the norm for people to have to check in and check out of buildings when they, you know, when you visit an office or something. And airports, you had all the scans and security scans at airports. All of that, he is very pleased about that, obviously. And he thinks that was all enabled by 9/11. And he also talks about the world wars. Well, this, you know, and I think that, that the world wars were certainly used to break down more of traditional society and thus of people's resistance, cultural resistance, to break down people's solidarity and connections, and to advance the agenda of whatever it is, the thing. I've started calling it the thing because no existing terms seem to completely sum up what we're dealing with here.
Yeah, I like that, the thing. And you're correct on that. I mean, there's different labels you can attach to the thing, but in different ways they all seem to fall short. And also, you know, you hit on a really important component that anyone who has sort of become amateur historians and trying to study these agendas over the last couple of years and maybe even going further back comes to see very quickly that crises are often used to give people in power more power. I mean, it's just a tried and true method that they have perfected at this point to grow the thing. And whether that's a health crisis or a terror crisis or whatever the case may be. And then, you know, you don't even have to get into theories of, I remember from years ago with when it comes to 9/11 and people questioning the story of 9/11, there was two different camps. There was the made it happen on purpose or let it happen on purpose, right? I don't even think you really have to get sucked into, you know, kind of arguing over that. Maybe we'll never know. But whether, you know, these agendas and the people behind them allow things to happen or make them happen, or simply by, you know, random circumstance of the universe, which is difficult for me to imagine in these cases, because in the case of COVID, for example, we have obvious signs of foreknowledge at this point of people knowing that something was happening before the public did. But you also have that so many different agendas were checked off by COVID 1984, you know, in case of the goals of the fourth industrial revolution and moving to a technocratic world and, you know, remote learning, all these different agendas that just seem to advance because of these crises. They must be the luckiest people on earth, I guess. But I wanted to move now to one I appreciated from you, 10 things we have learned during the COVID coup. And you don't have to necessarily go through all 10 of these, but is there any, you know, specific insights from there that you think are worth sharing with the listener? I mean, again, I want to encourage everybody to go get a copy of this and to check out all of the writings, not only the ones that are listed here in Fascism Rebranded, but we're going to get into in a few moments some of your older writing as well on anarchism specifically. I'd like to talk about anarcho-perennialism in a few moments. But yeah, anything you want to share from these 10 things we've learned during the COVID coup?
Well, I'm trying to remember what they were now exactly. But it was a... I'll see if I can find it here, actually. But, well...
Here, I'll pull it up too as well. I'll put it up so we can both look at it. I think I got it. Yeah, this is one of the ones that I really enjoyed. I mean, I think it's easy for, especially in the time of the internet and people feeling so busy, that sometimes it is helpful to give people a simple list of things they can absorb on their own. And I think that's what you did well with this particular essay here. Here, I've got it pulled up now.
Yeah, it's quite short, but yeah, it's a condensation of probably things I'd already said, but it's good for myself as well, actually, to be able to, you know, try and reduce points to a sort of bare minimum. You get a certain clarity that you can sometimes lose when you're dealing with masses and masses of facts. And
I mean, there's been so much happening the last couple of years, and I think it's important, even as you said, this is like you took, you know, it's not super long, but it's condensing a lot of important ideas and insights. And I think even at the least giving people a little reminder of like, oh, wow, we did have that realization. For example, number four, so-called radical movements are usually nothing of the sort. From whatever direction they claim to attack the system, they are just pretending to do so and serve to channel discontent in directions which are harmless to the power clique and even useful to its agendas. You want to say anything else about that one? Like what specifically might have brought that realization? I mean, is this just in the sense of watching the radical movements not oppose the authoritarianism around COVID?
Yeah, I mean, I was personally very disappointed by the response of people I'd been working alongside. I'm disappointed, to put it mildly. I went on a whole journey of trying to understand why, because it just seems so incredible to me that people seem to, especially anarchists. I mean, the left, you know, if you're talking about the communists, or, you know, they've always been fans of the state when they think the state is doing what they want it to do. But if you're an anarchist and you're explicitly against state power, and you're also explicitly against the power of big business, and then big business and the state get together and you say, oh yeah, that's fine. And not only is it fine, but anyone who was in your ranks who dares to challenge this is suddenly, is excommunicated. Or if it was a religion, I would have been excommunicated. If it was a political party, I'd have been dragged up before the central committee and put on some sort of show trial.
Yeah, and I think that again, we kind of talked about this already, but I mean, just to reemphasize that, in the sense of building alliances that are radical alliances, anti-statist alliances, anti-authoritarian alliances, people focused on building a better world. I think a huge opportunity was missed by the various, you know, sectors of the political community that was anti-authoritarian during COVID. I mean, that's kind of hard to describe, because you have, as I said earlier, ex-Democrats in the U.S., ex-progressive people who feel like, no, that's not, or people who call themselves politically homeless, where they don't feel like their values have changed at all. But then the people that they used to support, or the party they used to support, has gone, in one direction or another, whether that's right or left or whatever. So you end up with this large mass of people and an amazing opportunity for building alliances. And I think in many ways, in different areas, this has been missed because of these sort of things that you were describing there. And your second, you're the fifth one right after that, it kind of continues similar thought. You say any dissident voice you have ever heard through corporate media is probably a fake. The system does not hand out free publicity to its actual enemies. And I think that's another great point as well. When you start seeing these movements coming together and they've got the backing of Nike and the banks and all the major corporations and the government's giving them airtime. And those are the sort of things that don't happen whenever somebody is serving an agenda that, or working towards an agenda that doesn't serve the state.
Yeah. And, and this is, I've been surprised by some of the, to find out the connections of some of the more radical voices that seemed to be vaguely, on my side of the political, spectacle or whatever. Naomi Klein, we might have suspected that she was, drifting towards a less radical position than she might have appeared to have been occupying 15, 20 years ago. And there was there's been a number. Rob Hopkins was another one. I don't know if you've heard of him, but he was behind the Transition Towns movement. And,
oh, yes.
He seemed to be saying the right things. But when I actually looked into his connections, he's totally in with all the WF crowd and the rest of it. It's and even various political groups that I've been involved in, anarchist type groups, have been getting money from networks of impact investors, which is financial networks who are, it's incredible when you look into it.
Well, I think that it's the scope of this. I've done some investigations and some reports on social impact investing and how those are going to tie in with social credit scores and ESG and the whole thing. And I think many of these topics, they're already pretty dense and maybe just too esoteric for the average person. But I do think even within so-called radical communities, anti-authoritarian communities, that there's a massive blind spot for these sort of things. Because as you point out here, just two more comments I want to make on this piece. The last one, you talk about progress. Well, we have people in certain communities that are in love with progress for the sake of progress. And even if they do have a anti-civilization or anti-industrial awareness, there are certain areas where they just assume progress is a good thing. And this, to me, takes you to your point number 9 about scientists cannot be trusted. They will use the hypnotic power of their white coats and authoritative status for the benefit of whoever funds their work and their lifestyle. And that's something that we really saw over the last couple of years. And I want to kind of dig in there for a moment, if we can. Why do you think And again, I'm not trying to pick on any particular sector of the political spectrum. I think this applies to anybody who, you know, if the lab coat fits, it fits, right? That people who, as part of their, you know, their love of progress, they are hypnotized, as you say here, by science, by alleged science, or by people who proclaim to be representatives of Science Inc., you know, of this scientism almost that people talk about. It has become a new form of fanaticism or dogmatic at the least. Why is that? That is not only such a crucial component to this agenda of the thing, as you put it, but also it seems like such a huge mountain for some people to overcome, to come to the point of questioning science and questioning what they have been shown in that particular area. Like, it seems to be one of these, you know, golden calves in a way that many other areas are not.
Yeah. And they've, I suppose the problem is that it's what's being presented as science is the problem. I mean, probably, you know, a real scientist who is really dedicated to finding out the truth about things in general wouldn't be a problem. So I think this is always the problem with what we're facing today, is that things are presented as something which they're not. They're given a label, and people thus swallow them because they believe the label rather than, and they don't look any further than the outside. People, you know, people swallow it's like with communism, say Soviet communism. Because communism was supposed to be about equality and fairness, some people thought that the Russian Revolution was going to bring that, and then it didn't. But because it was still called communism, you know, I'm talking about communists, you know, elsewhere in the world, they carried on supporting it because it had the label of communism, which was something they believed in. Of religions, you know, people believe in God, so they follow the commands of the church. But it's not the same thing, because the certain churches, I don't want to go into details about which ones, the Roman Catholic Church and the Pope. I'm not a great fan of what he's doing at the moment. They use people's real faith in order to sell them something else, and I think it's the same with science. It's not the fact that people are examining molecules or working out how things work or trying to understand the universe is the problem, which I think is what science was supposed to be. It's the fact that these particular scientists have been co-opted for another agenda and are using the status, people's interest and respect for science in order to push that agenda. And because religion doesn't work anymore to do that, because that's been on the wane for some decades and even longer perhaps. So they're now using this, but it's another tool. It's another way of doing the same thing. Hence the word hypnotic power. It's just another means of getting people to not question what they're told and just to accept the outer surface.
I would say. Yeah. Yeah, I agree with that. And I think that there's, you know, I did this article, this investigation a while back, actually during 2020. It was from a friend just kind of sent it my way, and it took me down a little rabbit hole of this theory called parasite stress theory. And it has been studied since the 70s. There's a number of different studies essentially looking at different types of global phenomenon like war, famine, weather disasters, and then of course pathogens and viruses spreading or what have you. And study after study, which has been documented now for going on 50 years, shows that the threat and the fear of pathogens is a very unique threat that creates this opportunity for governments to become more totalitarian, more corrupt, more oppressive. And then at the same time, they also, the different studies show that people themselves tend to become more obedient. They tend to expect obedience from others, and they tend to attack those who are not going along with the so-called rituals of, you know, sharing, hey, this is how we do things. And it was just so insightful whenever I found this and kind of dove in deeper, because I think that knowing that threat, knowing, you know, someone in the thing knew that this threat was a particularly strong threat in the psyche of human beings, and that there would be a very swift and strong reaction where people would demand authoritarianism to make them feel safer. And they would look to the people, the men in the lab coats, for the information they needed to make them feel safer. And so I think that, yeah, the role of science and health, and maybe it is because it's this specialized type of knowledge that the average person is aware of, like, okay, I don't know. I haven't gone to school for those things. So I'm kind of in the dark here. I'm just going to trust, my betters, if you will. And I think it comes back to me, just this false belief in authority time and time again leads people down these types of roads.
Hold that thought. Hey guys, this is Derek Bros with the Activation Podcast. And I want to tell you about a new project that I recently launched. It's called the Holistic Self-Assessment Online Course. And it's based on my 2018 book, The Holistic Self-Assessment. Now, some of you guys know that I released this book based off my experiences in prison. This is essentially the culmination of the process I took myself through while I was locked up behind bars, when I began meditating, when I began journaling, and really starting to heal my trauma and begin to align my thoughts, my words, my actions, and really live in line with my true purpose. So this book is meant to be a self-empowerment, self-help guide that helps you align your thoughts, words, and actions, your relationships, your habits, and make sure you are living in line with your goals and your principles. So I developed this 9-week course with the University of Reason, aka Autonomy. We put this course together for people like yourself to take it and walk through it chapter by chapter. I read the book with you. I give you tips and exercises. And there's actually two options. If you want to just do the DIY version, you can choose to work through the course yourself. If you'd like to pay a little bit of extra money, you can go ahead and get one-on-one sessions with myself, where I will counsel you and work through the book with you and answer any questions you have. So I really want to encourage you guys to check this out. The link will be in the description below where you are listening or watching. And I'll put the link to the Holistic Self-Assessment book as well, which you can download for free. And I want you to stay tuned, because we're getting ready to release the Holistic Self-Assessment audiobook, the Spanish version of the book, and an upcoming Holistic Self-Assessment 9-day challenge. So stay tuned, guys. Now let's get back to the podcast.
Yeah, I'm thinking about the church back in, hundreds of years ago, when it was all in Latin. And that suited them very well, because people didn't have access to, couldn't read the Bible, because it wasn't written in their language, in England anyway. And then when people did start to read it themselves, they could interpret it in whichever way they liked, and that sort of let the cat out of the bag, and all sorts of interpretations of the Bible showered forth and multiplied. But the science is that it goes back to that original idea of the knowledge that you can't have, that is owned by a certain group of people, and the general public haven't got the right to come to their own conclusions because they have to follow the science.
It's the next priest class, right? It's trust us, let us interpret the data for you.
Yeah. Well,
I want to shift gears here now and get into some of the other side of your writing, which I also really appreciate, because I think this is honestly, I think our mutual friend Crow with Nevermore Media, he just has been telling me we need to connect, because I guess he sees a similarity in both our interest in anarchism, our talking about the Great Reset and the Fourth Industrial Revolution, and then also talking about the what I would say is the kind of internal struggle, the internal journey, would you could dare to say spiritual, if you will. But I want to first start with going into this essay. If you recall, I know we've done quite a bit of writing, but this one called Another World Exists Within Us, because I think that's such an important reminder that during all the chaos that's going on, just giving a little bit to people back to remind them of the power that each of us do have within our minds. And also just that, I think the title says it perfectly, that another world exists within us. So could you tell us a little bit about the inspiration for that, and in general, your views on anarchism and how they do go beyond just the physical realm?
Yes. The other world that exists within us, I think I usually describe it as an archetype. I'm sure I must have said that in that essay. I'm quite influenced by Jung's ideas about the collective unconscious, and about innate ideas that form part of the structure of the human mind, and are not born with the individual, but are something that forms part of our of the world soul of humanity. And I think that you can see that there's an idea of a different way of living in all human culture and literature, even in the Bible with the Garden of evil, the Garden of Eden, which was corrupted by evil, and that we left, and that we wish we hadn't left. And like other writers, I interpret that as being a reference to a world before we had the structures of power and enslavement that we have today, but that remains present in our minds, even when it doesn't remain present in our official culture. And so we can access it. It's really spat upon by the powers that be today. You know, utopian, and you're just dreamers, you're hippies, you're naive, it's not realistic. as if only their world is realistic, and as if only their future is possible. But that's not true. Neither is true. And it's the fact that people have this vision within them that is something that we all share, I think, that we can access, even though we might not be conscious of it at the moment. That gives me hope, because I think with each new generation that's born, that yearning, that dreaming for that other world will be reborn with them, unless they manage to somehow modify our DNA so that we don't have that anymore, which I'm sure they'd love to, but I don't think they can. And so that will always be a potential. There will always be a potential that we will be able to steer ourselves towards that vision of how we ought to live and to be who we are meant to be and have relations with other people and the way they could and should be and will be again, I'm sure. So this does take me, I think it is, though I'm justifying it in terms of a collective unconscious. Well, I think the idea of the collective unconscious is spiritual in itself, isn't it? Wouldn't you say?
Yeah, I would agree with that. And I like, I'm highlighting some lines here on screen for those who are going to be seeing this on screen, because I think it really hints at what you're talking about. For one, I'll go back here. There's this moment where you say that this idea, it lives within, like you said, the collective conscious and the collective mind of the human species, that the ideal society does exist on an abstract level within the collective mind of the human species. And I think that's something that a lot of people resonate with on a deeper level, this idea that we have that potential within us to create something better, as you said, to push past the ideas of what is expected and what societies are acceptable and what ways of living are acceptable, and really to be able to even dream. I think that's something that more and more people are realizing, being able to dream, to imagine, to intend, to manifest for a better world is itself an act of rebellion, especially in these types of times, and especially in the face of the Great Reset, the technocracy that is literally, in some cases, vying for the human consciousness itself. And I like this part where you say here that even if certain individuals and groups have overridden this impulse, the impulse for mutual aid you're talking about, in favor of narrow self-interest, the collective desire for solidarity, freedom, autonomy, and a natural way of life remains innate to the human species as a whole. I'm just curious, like what calls you to explore anarchism in these different ways? Like, definitely I would say maybe in a more romanticized vision than some other anarchist writers, and maybe some would even be dismissive of that. Is that something you've come across, or like really what is it that inspires you to look at anarchism in this deeper, with this deeper lens?
Well, I mean, I suppose I've always had that sort of interest. I suppose it's just part of my own way of seeing things, but I came across anarchism perhaps in a different way to other people. Anyway, I came across it through books rather than through politics, really. I mean, the type of anarchism I read was classical anarchism. I mean, it was old fashioned anarchism, I suppose you would call it now. So it wasn't, I've never really been never really been aligned with the contemporary version entirely. Although, you know, when I think I was close to it in many ways, but perhaps the deep roots of my thinking weren't the same. Even if you know, even though I agreed on the actual politics we were expressing in our campaigning. And one of the anarchists that influenced me a lot was Gustav Landauer, who was a German Jewish anarchist and who was killed at the end of the Bavarian Revolution in 1918. Anyway, but he was a great mystic, and he was translated Meister Eckhart into modern German, I think. And but he was very broad in his vision. And that really appealed to me, and I already had that sort of, I was vaguely interested in sort of mystical ideas before then, and at that point I thought, well, that's interesting. You can be an anarchist and still have that, you know. So I've been trying to nurture that ever since. And you're right that it's not been it's often disliked. It was often long before the COVID thing. The people thought that, you know, this stupid sort of mentality in a lot of the anarchist movement, this no gods, no masters thing, which completely excludes all possibility of using the word spirit. You know, the moment you say that, it's just like people want to throw things at you.
Yeah, that's definitely something I've experienced as well. You know, I definitely have not taken it as deeply as you have, which I appreciate so much your efforts. But I've spent some years as well writing about what I saw as the intersection between anarchism and, again, broadly using the term spirituality. I published a book back in 2015 with a friend of mine where we explored some of these intersections, and we looked at Christianity, Buddhism, we looked at Taoism, a number of different traditions, and tried to you know, kind of look for anti-authoritarian roots, or at least, you know, see some of the earlier teachings. And in many cases, yeah, we found threads, at least, that you could pull that seemed like, okay, this is not this, despite what people believe, this particular tradition, which may have evolved later to become really about the priest class and the church and this and that, had some different, you know, teachings that were worth exploring. And so I've always been intrigued by that. And then I started to write about what I was calling holistic anarchism, and just taking a truly holistic approach with that, like looking at just not just the state, not just the economics, not just debating about future anarchist stateless societies and what that might look like, or these sorts of things, but really trying to see the ways that the individual, I mean, it is to me still an individualist anarchist strain, but it was basically trying to put more responsibility on the individual and say, okay, in which ways are we, you know, serving the ends of the thing and not our own goals? And part of that was taking a deeper look, like at your own spiritual nature, being open to exploring that realm. And so, yes, there's often chance of no gods, no masters and these sorts of things. And I've even heard some people try to flip that on his head and say all gods, no masters, you know, that we're all gods, or that, you know, just that all gods are acceptable, just different variations of that. But generally speaking, it's not something that has been welcomed. And I wanted to ask, as we start to get to wrapping up here, I wanted to ask for you to expand maybe on what you were just saying, because I think it relates to some of your other writing I found, because I know it touches on Gustav Landauer, who is, I think, well worth exploring for those who are not familiar. And this is an essay you wrote, I think, back in 2012, Rediscovering Anarcho-Perennialism. Yeah. Talk a little bit about that and some of your inspirations for that, and well, really, what does that mean to you?
Yes, I mean, yeah, I discovered a writer called René Guénon, who people may or may not have heard of. I completely by chance, somebody pointed out the book in a bookshop, a secondhand bookshop, a friend of mine, and she said, "Oh, that might interest you, Paul. I'll write about that, I think, in the essay." And because it's called "Crisis of the Modern World," I think that one. When obviously that there was a relation there with my political views, being a critic of the modern world. And I didn't really know who he was, but anyway, I ended up reading it and just loved it, and discovered the. Starting from Guénon, that there is this tradition called the perennialist tradition, or sometimes it's called the traditionalist movement, which posits that there is a root spirituality or metaphysics, even, because it's, you know, it's very developed. So it's developed stuff. It's not airy fairy, nice thinking. It's a very serious discipline, I'd have said, perennialism, you know, and there are a number of authors who are connected to it. One of whom is called, and it was called Ananda Kumaraswamy, who is half Indian or Ceylonese, I think, half English, and he was an anarchist. And I recognize a lot in a lot of what Guénon says is, I recognize anarchist ideas. I mean, he's particularly a strong critic of the modern world, but of consumer society as he knew it then, and of so-called progress, and of putting quantity before quality, which is an obvious, to me, that is an obvious spiritual link to what we call politics, you know, the rejection of money and of the supremacy of money. And I think that is, in a way, I discovered through reading that kind of work, in tandem with, at the same time as reading anarchist literature, I discovered that really the real motivation behind my own thinking and my own political involvement. I think I have a deep seated distaste for a world which is based on people making money and not caring about the consequences for nature or for other people or for society of their money-making endeavors. An aesthetic distaste for the products of their money-based world as well. And it's all come together. It's the aesthetics, the spiritual, the political. You can't separate them. It's all part of one deep-seated rejection of the thing, to come back to that phrase again.
I appreciate that, that explanation there, as far as, I mean, I definitely agree that there's something deeper when you start talking about and exploring anarchism, or at least maybe there is for some of us, beyond just calling for, freedom and liberation in the sense of your physical body and self-ownership and, the right to live free on this planet. And as you said, to have informed in our lives, how we interact with the planet. And just, there's so many different interconnections I see there when it comes to spirituality, when it comes to the search for freedom. And for me, I've often kind of seen that the church and the state clearly work together, but I think sometimes anarchists especially miss the fact that, yes, the state and the capitalist class and what I call the predator class, they aim to control our minds and our bodies and to profit off that and exploit that. But there's also the church, which clearly many anarchists have become aware of. And that's why, as we've mentioned earlier, there's often a very anti-religion, anti-spirituality, anti-anything beyond the five senses mentality, a very materialistic worldview. And I can understand that. But to me, if you see that it's not just that the church was trying to abolish reason or control people's ability to understand the world around them, but I think it was also trying to become a gatekeeper between us and the collective consciousness, the spirit, what many in our native communities call Wakantanka, the great mystery. You know, there's something deeper than we can understand, but that we can connect to on some level in our own ways. And I think that's important to explore as well, right? So I see like some of the anarchists might even just dismiss many of this conversation, which, I mean, this whole area of research that you're describing here is, I think, is just fascinating. I'm excited to dive further into some of your writing on this, but I think there's a huge blind spot for many in the radical anarchist community because of their understanding that the church was used as an instrument for control and manipulation, that they also might not see that there still is some importance to exploring, those deeper realms and informing your anarchism with your understanding of those experiences.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
Well, so let's see. Is there anything else you wanted to mention as far as specifically about anarcho-perennialism? Maybe besides your essay here, which I think is a great starting point, any other resources you might want to suggest for someone who's interested in kind of diving deeper into this topic?
Yeah, well, there's the Organic Radicals website, which I set up, which is which in fact has profiles of some of the perennialist writers that I've mentioned in that essay, and also of anarchist writers and others who are just other writers that I see as being part of this tradition, which I've decided randomly to call organic radicalism, but it could be called something else. And I'm very much there trying to make the connection between all these different thinkers and schools of thought, and explore the there are actually some actual physical connections between them. You know, it's that people who have inspired other people you might not have imagined would have had anything to do with each other, but also just generally in the way that the ideas mesh together. So I don't know, that would be a good. I wrote the website, so I would recommend it, wouldn't I? But if people are interested, you or other people are interested in exploring some of these thinkers from the perennial tradition, that would be one place to go to.
Perfect. That's a great resource. Yeah, we'll put all these links in the show description wherever you guys are watching, including to the Organic Radicals website. We'll put the Rediscovering Anarcho-Perennialism link. We'll link to Fascism Rebranded and, of course, to Winter Oak and all of your really just amazing work here that I'm so thankful to be discovering more myself, and I look forward to learning more about. Let's wrap, Paul, with just sharing, if you will, if you feel inclined, a little bit of advice to the audience listening. You know, this podcast, the Activation Podcast, it's one of many different forms of content I do, but I started this in 2021 with the specific goal of having important conversations like this, with a focus on solutions. So maybe we can end there. We've talked about a lot. We've talked about the Fourth Industrial Revolution, the Great Reset. We've talked about some of these ways that certain groups haven't been able to see what's going on, you know, and have chosen not to see what's going on. We're here now in the summer 2022. Things have maybe calm down for the moment, but many of us see that these agendas by the thing are not just going to go away, that they are, they're aiming at the year 2030 and beyond. So is there any bit of advice or optimism, if you have any, or, realism that you would like to offer the listening audience today?
I think it's important to remember that there are far, far more of us than there are of them. Of these people behind the Great Reset and the thing in general, and that they're actually scared of us. Otherwise, they wouldn't need to bombard us with all this propaganda constantly, and censor us and try and stop us from connecting with each other. So we got to make their worst fears come true and connect with each other in whichever way we can. I think it's really good to do it on a local level if you can. I mean, I know some people don't live in close to others, so they can't do that perhaps. But I've been very happy to have met new people on the basis of our opposition to what's been happening here in France over the last couple of years. I've met new people who I didn't know before, and we're forming a tight group who not only have the same ideas but are also looking to become more autonomous and to work together. And I mean, it's a slow process, but with a vision of trying to become independent, or try not to depend on the state, to be to try and move towards creating the world that we want to see, although obviously it's not going to be totally possible when we're still in the shell of the old one.
Yeah, that's I think it's a worthy goal, though, Paul, I would say. And that's one of the things myself and I hope many of the listeners are aiming for as well, because wherever you're listening from, whatever part of the world you're in, I think that is the real solution. It's something I've been calling exit and build for the last few years, is focusing on exiting these old systems as much as possible while still, you know, exposing them where we can, but really focusing on building new parallel systems, parallel institutions, and building, as you said, the local support networks that we're going to need to make it through what we are facing. There are way more of us than there are of the thing, and yet we are still dealing with some difficult realities, you know, things like inflation and others that are a part of this agenda. And so the more you are established locally with a community of people, whatever that might look like in your area, or even just within your own family, I think the better off you're going to be. So that's a great place to leave it. Guys, this has been a conversation with Paul Kudnack, and he is writing at winteroak.org.uk. All the links will be in the description below. I hope you enjoyed this conversation. As always, remember, you are powerful, you are beautiful, and you are free. Peace. Thank you for listening to the Activation Podcast, brought to you by the Conscious Resistance Network. You can find the archives of our show on Spotify, Pinecast, and at theconsciousresistance.com. Thanks for listening.